The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Greg Hurwitz. He joins us on the phone in Southern California. He's got a new Orphan X novel. It's called Prodigal Son. Welcome back, Greg.
Thanks for having me back on.
Is this book six in this series?
It is indeed.
Wow. I was up till 2 a.m. Finishing this book last night. It's a real page-turner. I had no problem staying awake.
Well, excellent. Thank you. I always like when I destroy people's sleep. That's sort of the aim.
Yeah, well, you hit me right in the noggin. We have some listeners out there who aren't familiar with this series. Can you give us a little background on it, what it's based on?
Absolutely. So my main character, his name is Evan Smoke, and his code name was Orphan X, and he was taken out of a foster home at the age of 12 and just taken off the books, totally off the radar, and trained up to be an assassin for the U.S. government, a sort of disposable asset. They took kids out of foster homes who they considered expendable weapons. But the thing for me was, it's not a trope with which we're unfamiliar. And the thing that I wanted to do is make it not where it was all sort of hardship and brutality, but where the handler who takes him out of this foster home in East Baltimore actually really loves him. And wants to keep his humanity intact. His name is Jack Johns. And so he raises Evan. One of the key lines for me is when he tells Evan, the hard part's not making you a killer. The hard part is keeping you human. And so he raises him with a sense of morality intact. And at a certain point in the earlier books, you know, we discover that Evan's participation in the program, you know, crashed into the moral compass, which he had intact. And he leaves the program. He's on the run. He knows way too much for the government to have him be alive. For his, you know, there's too much in his head for it to stay attached to his shoulders, because he doesn't just know where all the berries are bodied. He buried most of them. Uh-huh. But the thing is he has a phone now that's on an encrypted line. He lives undercover under a cover identity among ordinary people, and the phone rings for people who are in desperate need. He has a phone number that gets passed along, and he is essentially like a pro bono assassin. If people are in a horrible situation at the hands of an abuser, a bully, a tyrant, they can call this number if they get it, and he will come in because he's got this incredible skill set and training, and he's kind of a lone wolf now out in the world to help people. And the end of the last book, the phone rings, and rather than it being another ordinary, desperate person on the other end of the line, he answers, and a woman says, "Evan, it's your mother." And he never knew that his mother, has no memories of that, came up in the system in the foster homes. And so this woman's claiming to be his mother, and she pulls him into, when we open Prodigal Son, this sort of intrigue and adventure that takes him back to his earliest memories in the foster home and propels him forward into an intrigue that reaches into the highest levels of power.
And as this book opens, Prodigal Son, he is not answering that phone anymore and doing that job anymore, right?
That's right. He's thought about, he has an unofficial presidential pardon that he's not to participate in any sort of activities that showcase who he is or his talent. So as long as he doesn't answer that phone and commit to any more missions, the government will stop searching for him. And so that's an agreement that he's made. But when the call comes from his mother, his curiosity gets the better of him. He wants to determine, is it really his mom? Is it a scam? Is it somebody playing him? Is it someone to draw him out from cover? And he gets pulled out step by step. He gets dragged back into this, you know, world of power and menace.
In case you're just joining us, my guest today is Greg Hurwitz. We're talking about his new Orphan X novel. It's called Prodigal Son. And the title kind of reveals that connection. If readers weren't reading the end of that last book and they didn't know about that phone call, they didn't really need to read that. These can stand on their own, I think. Don't you agree?
That's right. I write each one so that new readers can jump in at any point. So there's some Easter eggs in there for people who have been reading and enjoying the series, but I need each novel to be its own entry point. So people can pick this up knowing nothing of the world, and there's enough information that I can kind of pull them into the world of Orphan Acts.
Well, I think the last time I had you on the show was for the Orphan X book, in which his nemesis in the story is a kid who was kind of his nemesis in the orphanage or the foster home. And what was that, a couple books ago?
Well, the first three, we see Charles Van Sciver, who is Orphan Y. And even though the orphans don't know each other, Evan has some overlap and familiarity, you know, based on rumors and some sort of random assignations with this guy. This is the first book where we go back and actually see that they knew each other back in the foster home. And I write, and you know, some of those scenes come forth. And so I'm filling in a bit of backstory to what this relationship is. I thought of Van Sciver as kind of his Moriarty.
Uh-huh.
I'm a big fan of Sherlock Holmes. And so Van Sciver is someone who represents in a lot of ways the opposite of Evan. Van Sciver is a true believer. So Evan was raised, you know, to stay human. He was the smallest kid in the foster home.
Mm-hmm.
He was tiny, and he just had grit. And so there's this interesting thing when Jack chooses him against all kind of recommendations. You know, and Evan says, why'd you pick me? He's the smallest kid. And Jack tells him, you know what it feels like to be powerless. Mm-hmm. You know that in your bones. And I need someone who will never forget that. And that's a big part of his humanity, whereas Charles Van Sciver was the biggest, strongest kid and a bully. And when he entered the orphan program at the hands of another handler, he was raised to be a true believer. And being a true believer, you know, can be awful because you're gripped in the clutch of an ideology at all times. But it's also easier because you just have your directives and off you go. And Evan, you know, it's complicated because being a killer and staying human are sort of two trains on a collision course. And so a lot of the series is about his psychology. And about his trying to become and find his way towards, you know, towards an understanding of ordinary life. He doesn't speak the strange language of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's perfectly comfortable calculating the wind drift of a sniper round, but if he has to make small talk at the mail slots of the apartment in which he hides under a cover identity, he's undone, right? So he's always getting pulled into, like, these annoying HOA meetings, you know, covering up injuries that he has. Nobody knows what he does. And the interplay between the real world where you and I live and the grand archetypal world is there's a lot of fun and humor and I hope poignancy in that. Because one thing we don't get to see with these archetypal characters is we don't see James Bond go home. We don't see Jason Bourne have an awkward encounter with the head of an HOA who wants to discuss, you know, carpet pile ratios for the new rug in the lobby with him. While he's, you know, while his life is at risk and he's trying to hurry back to make plans for the next leg of the mission.
I like that comparison of Van Sciver to Moriarty. I also get a little Darth Vader from him.
Yeah, he's not a good character.
Okay, so
you know, anyone who believes they have an absolute hold on the world and how it operates and have an adherence to it, they're dangerous. Ideologues are so dangerous. And so Van Sciver is sort of like the perfect orphan in some ways. And Evan, in a lot of ways, is the most flawed because he considers the human aspect of it. That part of him was never snuffed out. And I think that's why he does these missions now for people who are in desperate situations, because it's almost like he has his face up to the glass looking at ordinary people leading the kinds of ordinary lives that he himself never can based on his upbringing, based on his wanted status. But at least he can protect for them to have a life that feels normal and has intimacy in it. He can protect their relationships. He can protect what it is that they have. And it's sort of a bit of atonement. I think it's almost like he gets a little piece of his soul back with each of these missions, where he helps other people to have the sort of life that he himself can never have. There's a almost tragic element to it.
He also feels a really strong attraction to a woman in the building who has a young son that she's raising alone. And these are some of the more powerful charged moments in the book, is when he's interacting with this 9-year-old boy.
That's right. I mean, I think for me, a lot of it is, The series is a process of him thawing out. I mean, I think we've all seen the kind of lone wolf assassin kinds of narratives. And it's important to me that he's somebody who, I almost think of it like he realizes when we open the whole series that he's Pinocchio, but he wants to be a real boy. Mm-hmm. He realizes he's been living under these intense strictures. Jack Johns bequeaths him the Ten Assassins' Commandments, the rules to live by. Never make it personal. Assume nothing. How you do anything is how you do everything. And so there's these really strict rules and guidelines, but we're seeing the process of him starting to break those rules and guidelines to figure out what it means to be human, what it means to apply some of the lessons that he's learned, you know, tactically and strategically to emotional engagements and situations. And he's not very good at them, but he is reaching out. The woman downstairs, Mia Hall, she's a defense attorney, or she's a prosecutor. And so they have this like really intense chemistry and attraction. But if she ever really knew who he was, she'd have to arrest him. And her husband passed away. She's got a 9-year-old boy. And I think in Peter, in her boy, Evan sees a reflection of who he was as a boy if he was raised more lovingly, right? Mm. If he was raised in a situation that was more normal. So it's sort of this painful contrast and foil to him in his own life and his own upbringing, which was, you know, he was being drown-proofed. He was, you know, figuring out how to survive enhanced interrogation. The training and rigors of what he went through were pretty brutal. He was being taught how to fight hand-to-hand, how to do a scream of knife fighting. And so with Peter, who's this very sweet, open kid, he can see a sort of reflection of what would have been his own better self, his own more pure inner child that he was never allowed to kind of embody.
My guest is Greg Hurwitz. We're talking about his new Orphan X novel, Prodigal Son. He joins us on the phone in Los Angeles. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, amplifying voices from every corner of our community. And I love the interplay in the story and in the books between Joey and our Mr. X. Tell us about Joey. What a wonderful character she is.
Oh, thank you. Joey's a 16-year-old hacker. She was a washout from the orphan program. And a few books ago in Hellbent, Evan was tasked by Jack Johns as kind of a last mission to protect her. She was a washout from, like I mentioned, from the orphan program, and there was assassins on her tail to want to wipe her out along with everyone else. And so Evan stuck with her. The last thing he wants is a mouthy 16-year-old genius hacker girl, right, who gives him a hard time. She's funnier than he is. She's quicker than he is in certain regards. She's certainly a much better hacker. And they have this exchange, and it's really interesting. When I was writing Hellbent in the outline, I don't really have a full traditional outline, but in my thinking, in my notes, she was supposed to die at the end of that story.
Oh.
And I got there. I got to the end, and you can see, you know, those readers of the series will know exactly which scene I'm talking about in Hellbent towards the end, where, you know, she's there and set to die, and I just couldn't do it. I'd sort of fallen in love with her. I'd fallen in love with her energy, with her voice, her tone, and most importantly, with the aspects of Evan that she can bring out with her kind of unabashed, toughened vulnerability. She's so much fun to write, and she kind of holds him to account. And in a weird way, you know, he's like an uncle. She calls him her uncle person. He's almost like this, it's kind of avuncular, it's sort of paternal, but he has this process of really coming to love her, in which is something he'll never sort of admit or acknowledge, but he's opened himself all the way to her in his role as her sort of mentor and protector in a way that brings up all sorts of confusing emotions and operational vulnerabilities for a guy who was raised on, you know, the fourth commandment is never make it personal. Mm-hmm. So this is against every rule that he was raised with and governs by, but there's something about Joey that owns a part of his heart and always will. And so their exchange to me is always, it's fun, it's flawed. He doesn't quite know what to do. He doesn't speak the strange language of intimacy. She's not so good at it either. But there's an unbelievable bond between them. And in a lot of ways, I think she's emerged as the most important secondary character, if I can call her that, of the series.
I remember that in Hellbent. That was the last time we had you on the show, was for that novel. And Joey, she really opens the window for you to delve into technology. And this series is such a great reservoir of high-tech stuff. People that are into technology will just eat this stuff up. And what an amazing pile of tech. Sometimes I'll get into a paragraph and I'm just like, what? I have no idea what they're talking about.
Well, the aim for me always is, you know, I don't write, as much as I you know, greatly admire Tom Clancy and Michael Crichton, I don't write sort of tech-forward books in that. My aim is always to take it. I want to kind of carry the reader across the suspension of disbelief. I want them to feel like it's real and living and breathing. But my aim is to get it boiled down to language, plot terms, and character beats that people can really understand and relate to. And so that's, I consider that my goal. I think of these as primarily emotional and psychological thrillers more than research or tech thrillers. But I have to get my, you know, my gun, weapons, and material stuff right. So I have an incredible consultant who I work with on that. I have to get the medical right for my injuries. I have, you know, an ER doc who helps me with that. And I have some, you know, hacking experts who are world-renowned hackers who come in and tell me kind of how that all works. And in the process of them explaining it to me and me trying to keep up with them with their areas of expertise, when I understand it, I can get it into a book in a way I hope that feels that's manageable and feels like it's opening up a new world to readers of possibilities, but it's more about the emotional impact of what the technologies are. It's more about what the what role they play in the story than about just sort of spending five pages on a hacking, you know, routine.
My guest is Greg Hurwitz. We're talking about Prodigal Son. It's his sixth Orphan X novel. He joins us on the phone in Southern California. All right. Let's set the stage here. Tell us how the book begins, what you can tell about it.
Well, Evan Smoke gets a phone call. Again, it's the woman who's claiming to be his mother. He's not supposed to have anything to do with any operation or any mission beyond enjoying himself in retirement, unless he's going to risk his informal presidential pardon or the informal agreement he has that the government will stop going after him, trying to find him. So he decides, the call originates from Buenos Aires, and he decides that what he's going to do is just take a fly down there and take a look. The curiosity is too great about this woman and whether she's his mother or whether it's a ruse to draw him out. So he gets on a plane, and he goes down to Buenos Aires, and he's sort of staking her out and can't see her. She's across a plaza, and she has two bodyguards, which is unusual. She has a big wide-brimmed hat down over her face. And he follows her into, there's a beautiful old cemetery that's almost like a mini, it's called Recoleta. It's almost like a mini city in Buenos Aires. And he goes in there at dusk, and he's following her through. And, of course, her bodyguards, you know, try to corner him, and he has a physical interaction with them that doesn't go so well for them. And he goes up to her, and right when he is going to have an exchange to determine whether or not she's his mother, the whole cemetery lights up, and we have two helicopters overhead, and half of the Argentine police force basically wheels in and surround the cemetery, and he has to walk out with this woman who he's trying to determine whether or not she's his mother into the hands of seemingly a foreign government and figure out how to escape and also have an engagement with her. And that, I would say, is the opening. That's the fuse that lights. That's the lit fuse that takes us into the story. And from there, you know, what he discovers from this woman, there's a series of clues that lead him back all the way to his past, that leads him back into the foster home that he grew up in. It leads him back to all these memories that are, A, he has some survivor's guilt for being, you know, most of these other foster kids are dead or in jail or on drugs. And B, I think he's got some shame about this life that he left behind and its dirtiness and its the poverty. He's got a lot of feelings around that. And so it drags him back to his past and to his upbringing in some ways that he's never visited before. And at the same time, the story itself is reaching forward and forward and forward through opening up these new worlds and parting curtains into military technologies under development from, you know, a Silicon Valley visionary all the way through top military bases. And so the story goes two ways. It goes smaller, more intimate back into the past, and then escalating forward to ever-increasing threats to him and his life. Mm. And so that weight and counterweight for me forms the spine of Prodigal Son.
Are you familiar with a writer named Nick Petrie?
Yeah, I have blurbed Nick's books. I've interviewed Nick. I think he's quite a talent.
We had him on recently for that new book, and I was reading your book, and I was like, wow, Silicon Valley guy misusing technology for military hardware, and I just kind of went, whoa, this is a theme that's really on people's minds.
Well, there's a ton of overlap. I haven't read Nick's latest. Yeah, I mean, there's common themes of what's emerging, right? There's new versions of the military-industrial complex, you know, that has a lot of overlap, as we're seeing, between Silicon Valley is one of the power centers of the world right now. And so I like the way Nick plays with themes, and I like the way that he writes characters. He's quite a talent.
Well, didn't you grow up kind of in Silicon Valley?
I did.
Okay.
I grew up, yeah, before the dot-com era and then through it. So it's changed quite a bit. I grew up in the early kind of Hewlett-Packard days.
Okay.
And then the explosive growth of that and the accumulation, I think it's the largest accumulation of wealth at any one place in the history of the world, has been staggering. And so, and I had some friends who were, you know, CEOs and kind of tech visionaries in Silicon Valley. And so I wanted to part the curtain on that a little bit and take people behind to what a big decadent Dionysian Silicon Valley funders party looks like, because there's a lot that goes on there. And so that's a really sort of interesting world that I explore. And Evan at one point finds himself in a mansion in Atherton where there is a kind of really raucous party going on, and he navigates his way through that to the heart of the matter.
Greg Hurwitz joins us. We're talking about Prodigal Son, his new Orphan X novel. If I had to pick a one-word theme for this novel, in my own mind, it would be mothers. And I'm thinking not just of some of the main characters, but I'm thinking about this guy, this hired killer. And we feel sympathy for this guy because he had a bad mother.
That's right. It's funny how these themes will emerge sometimes. I mean, that wasn't something I consciously charted out. A lot of writing comes from the gut, right? I'll be in it and I'll be thinking about a character. And sometimes these themes just lay down on top of each other. And that's right. I have an antagonist. There's a brother-sister hitman team. They're from Philly. And I wanted to figure out a way to show their very real love and affection for each other. It's also creepy. Even as they are, you know, undertaking horrific acts. They're torturing people to get information. You know, their job is to come out and act as cleaners in the wake of, you know, behind someone who they're taking their orders from, who goes by the title of the doctor, who's looking to clean up a trail. And so they're pretty horrific, but I always want to find a point of purchase for readers to understand the true love and affection that they have together, having survived a household that was pretty abusive at the hands of their mother. And he in particular was targeted by the mother. And so they have these really interesting memories and an interesting shared, it's almost like they share a brain. They're twins, and they verge on being able to read each other's thoughts. They're so close. And so I thought that was an interesting thing to throw at Evan on the ground, to have this brother-sister team be there to try and kill him.
I love good villains, and you've got some great ones in this story, like the doctor you mentioned. I'm not going to say anything more about the doctor, but this is a great villain.
Thank you. It was, you know, I feel like in some ways I always want to have antagonists who have a legitimate point of view. I always want steel men, not straw men. I want us to feel like when we look at them, whether it's the doctor or Declan or Queenie, Declan and Queenie being the brother and sister assassin team, I want people to understand that it's almost like they take a worldview that's relatable to us, and then it's just twisted 15 degrees. They need to have a point of view that we feel like we can access that speaks to some part of us. And that's important to me. It's important to me to have them be fleshed out, to be full in a certain way, instead of just, you know, sort of pure evil, which then would make Evan pure good. And no one is either of those things. Those things don't interest me. I'm interested in the flaws and the vulnerabilities and the blind spots, right, that we have morally and emotionally and psychologically.
Well, thanks for bringing back Candy. It was fun to see her again. My guest is Greg Hurwitz. His book is Prodigal Son. And one thing that I enjoyed about your portrayal of Evan in these books is that he's obsessive compulsive. And it really bugs him when he's visiting someplace and stuff just isn't the way he wants it to be. It just really drives him crazy.
That's right. Well, the second commandment, which is most people's favorite, is the second assassin's commandment that Jack gave to him, is how you do anything is how you do everything.
Uh-huh.
And so he has a really perfectionistic approach, right? It's really about focusing and doing the thing that is before you as well as possible. That's always the aim. And there's places where that can leak into obsessiveness, especially if his anxiety or his anxiety is the wrong word. It's more like if he's under operational threat, right? If the more stressful circumstances that he's in, the more that little operating system can misfire, and it leads him to notice every flaw, every smudge, every speck of dirt. And so how you do anything is how you do everything. It's a wonderful tool for training, for operating, for aligning yourself with being present and pointing yourself always towards the outcome that is the most helpful. But if that software grabs hold of your brain too much, it can kind of misfire. And so he has to hold that part of himself at bay. I don't think anybody has a blessing without a curse. It's hardly a new thought. But for him, you know, the sort of operational perfection that he was raised in, that he strives for, that's necessary for him to live the life that he needs to live, it has a cost as well. And that's one of the costs.
Mm. I'm looking at your press packet here that your publisher sent me. And it says that in the audiobook version, there's some bonus material where you talk about my favorite peripheral character, Tommy Stojak. That sounds like a fun thing, a fun bonus.
Yeah, we do a little mini audio documentary almost, talking to different people. I tell some stories about Tommy. He's based on a now departed friend of mine. And we talk about his slaying and his influence. He's a nine-fingered armorer and marksman who lives in Vegas. And he and Evan have a sort of clandestine relationship. You know, they don't know exactly all the contours of each other's past, but they sense in each other a common soul. They trust each other, and that's very rare for Evan. And Tommy's a really gruff. He's got, you know, a biker's mustache. He's always chewing tobacco and smoking Camel-wide cigarettes and slurping coffee and working on guns. And he designs ghost weaponry. He's sort of like Evan's version of Q, but insanely less polished, right, and more kind of grit and menace to him. He's something else, Tommy. And Tommy's also not afraid to tell Evan why he thinks, you know, he's a superior marksman. So even though Evan, in a lot of ways, is a much more well-rounded operator or assaulter, you know, Tommy makes fun of him for being a mouth-breathing trigger puller, not knowing all the intricacies and finer points of weapons. So there's a lot of interplay between them that can be amusing.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure to talk to you about your work.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
My guest has been Greg Hurwitz. His new one is Prodigal Son. You heard about it on the Book Nook. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.